welcome to The Wire, Community Radio's national independent current affairs program. I'm Bonnie Parker in Adelaide. Today on the show...
You know, I think the model that's being proposed will simply mean that our Indigenous kids continue to miss out and continue to fall behind.
What Gonski 2.0 will mean for Indigenous students and...
I love your culture of bring a plate. I could not understand what that meant, you know, when I first came to Australia. Well, I was thinking, don't they have enough plates?
Being an expat, how hard is it to get used to our strange Australian ways? Also, confrontational politics is on the rise in Venezuela. So stay tuned for these stories and more coming up on The Wire.
This action today because we are shocked and appalled at the decision that management has taken. The scale of these cuts proportionally is unprecedented.
Sean Nichols of the Sydney Morning Herald speaking at a rally following Fairfax's announcement of cuts to a quarter of its journalists at metropolitan newspapers. While these cuts are becoming a part of a familiar story, freelance journalist Dr. Margaret Simons is concerned that more cuts mean less content, especially in areas that are already being neglected. She spoke to The Wire's Tom Johnston.
I think what we're rapidly losing is authoritative coverage of the affairs of the city and the state. Both the existing players and some of the new players, such as The Guardian in Australia, for example, are still covering federal politics. But what we're losing quite rapidly now is the very important but comparatively non-glamorous reporting of parliaments, the court, the affairs of the state and the city.
Freelancing as well is becoming all the more common, and news corporations themselves are using it as well. Do you think this is at all viable?
For now, yes. And in fact, in the short term, some of these cuts might be quite good for freelancers because the products will still be trying to fill the space so that they can sell advertising alongside it. But of course, in the long run, if a business like Fairfax ultimately either breaks up or ceases to be in the news business, both of which are possible, then that will be bad for freelance journalists as well. Against that, we do have multiple new entrants to the news business, all of which tend to operate on fairly small newsrooms, and they do bring the potential opportunities for freelancers.
And with less journalists and less voices, do you think this will impact political balance and the overall quality of the journalism?
Well, it inevitably has an effect. It's completely false to suggest that you can cut newsrooms to this extent without affecting the quality and the extent of the journalism. But of course, we do actually have more voices, if you mean more owners, than we had 5 years ago. As I mentioned, there are multiple new entrants in particularly web-based news reporting. They tend to specialise on particular areas, leaving gaps.
Do you think there's potential for almost a reverse and an oversaturation of these smaller companies?
Well, I don't think you can ever have too many voices, but of course financial viability is a key issue for all news media companies across the Western world. The advertising online is also drying up, not because it's disappearing, but because more and more of the advertising dollars are ending up in the pockets of Facebook and Google. Many, many millions of dollars are going to those two large international corporations without a single journalist.
Dr. Margaret Simons, journalist and political activist Professor Wendy Bacon, doesn't see these sort of cuts stopping anytime soon.
Big job cuts announced today, 25% of all journalists from the Fairfax Metropolitan masthead. That is a very serious cut indeed, and is on top of, you know, hundreds of jobs that have already gone. So that and the very bad report on press freedom today from the Media Entertainment and Arts Alliance, that's the union. It's a pretty grim day in Australia for journalism.
Wendy also has some concerns about freelance journalism.
Well, look, it's not a really good option. Like, I think freelancing is a potential option for journalists, but it can't replace consistent, ongoing reporting unless they can actually put a freelancer on a retainer of some sort and say, look, you follow that trial or you follow that case, you follow that issue. And really, in journalism, follow through is really what matters. You know, you can do one story, but unless you follow up and you ask questions and you demand answers, it really becomes sort of somewhere between journalism and PR, I think.
With less full-time journalists, that means generally less content. Will the jobs go somewhere else?
Well, look, I mean, I don't necessarily think the jobs will go somewhere else. I just notice how whole issues just don't get covered at all. And that really matters. I mean, it doesn't just matter for journalists in the end, but it's actually the public that pays. You know, we always talk about the job losses, but actually need to think in terms of the content that isn't done. I mean, there also needs to be ways of thinking about how we resource the community with information in the absence of solid journalism.
There might be more bias and more control over what's going on in these companies. Do you think that's an issue as well?
Well, look, I think that's true. It's already very large amounts of PR. That is where you could trace it to government statements or big company statements or organisation statements, which then get reproduced through the media. And unless you actually have the time to then make other calls, check out information, get other angles, you might as well say that that becomes a form of propaganda.
Professor Wendy Bacon. Dr. Margaret Simons thinks journalism taught at universities is headed in the right direction.
Today's university journalism graduate is multi-skilled, understands the journalistic use of social media, understands the fact that the industry and the profession are at a time of profound change, and that it will in effect be them who have to rebuild it and remake it.
Freelance journalist and director of the Centre for Advancing Journalism, Dr. Margaret Simons, speaking with The Wire's Tom Johnston.
Reception isn't always the best out here in the bush. But if I miss The Wire, I listen to the podcast.
The Wire, across Australia, weeknights on Indigenous and Community Radio, and now podcast.
Yesterday, the government announced Gonski 2.0, a remodelling of the Labor government's Gonski education funding scheme. Jordan Curtis from our newsroom is here to tell us what the latest is on the story. Hi, Jordan.
Hi, Bonnie.
So where are we at with Gonski 2.0?
Well, the announcement has brought on a lot of attention to what the government would like to do with the education sector. And as you can imagine, the opposition party are in opposition to the proposal. Bill Shorten, in fact, called it an act of political bastardry. So what the government have done is taken the Labor Party's Gonski program and they've decided to fund it, but not as much as they would have, the Labor government would have liked. And now we'll only see an increase of up to 75% of the funding by 2027. The Gonski 2.0 model will be needs-based, which means that the funding schools receive will be in accordance to the funding they require and not an equal amount of funding across the board. Greens education spokesperson, Senator Sarah Hanson-Young, says funding for public schools should be the priority.
We have to be investing in our public school system and lifting the quality of teaching for our kids. I think the argy-bargy over schools' funding has become so toxic in this country that we've had children forgotten. Every election, you have the debate over how much money is going to be put in or ripped out of the school system. Let's cut through that, do our job as politicians, and give our schools and our children and our families certainty.
And we'll also have more on the Gonski reform later in the program.
And one of Australia's biggest banks has announced its support for renewable energy.
Yeah, that's right. Westpac this week released its position statement and action plan on climate change. In the document, they announced that they will provide financing for climate change solutions and support businesses who decide to cut back on their climate change contribution. Westpac's stance on coal is part of a growing trend among Australian businesses, following energy companies AGL and Origin. Earlier, I spoke with business commentator Stephen Mayne, and he says it makes economic sense for companies to back renewable energies.
Coal and carbon-intensive companies have been a very poor performer on the stock market in recent years. So it's actually been good for investors to reduce their exposure to carbon. And I think basically the banks are starting to realise that as well, that it's actually good for business because the investment dollars are heading away from coal in particular. Governments are not going to sanction coal around the world, but global policies are moving to price carbon. That makes coal uneconomic in many circumstances. So, I think it's just the reality of where the world is going.
Now, today is also World Press Freedom Day.
Yes, it is. Now, in its 24th year, UNESCO's World Press Freedom Day is designed to celebrate the fundamental principles of press freedom. One of the biggest press freedom issues this year is the detaining of journalists in Turkey for publishing anything negative against the government. Following the coup attempt in Turkey last year, the president has been focused on locking up journalists who oppose him in the media. According to Amnesty International, there are more than 120 journalists currently locked up in Turkey, with an estimated 2,500 journalists also having lost their jobs. In a story closer to home, though, student media from the University of Sydney have been denied entry to the budget release next week, despite cuts to higher education being one of the most controversial announcements ahead of the budget.
Thanks, Jordan. Well, the federal government surprised everyone this week by taking David Gonski into their camp and producing a new model for education funding. The Wire's Catherine Andrews reports.
The Labor Party and the unions have had the rug pulled out from under them this week, with the news that their education guru, David Gonski, has become the Liberal Party's new guru working on a different model for funding education. Meredith Peace from the Australian Education Union says the new model is unlikely to work.
The original Gonski agreement, which are the agreements that are in place now, deliver a certain amount of funding, and those agreements were put in place in consultation with the states and territories with different sectors across education. What we see here in Gonski 2.0 is a Turnbull government going it alone, in effect creating more funding wars as opposed to what they've claimed that they're solving those problems. They've said, we'll provide this amount of money and we'll just leave it up to the states and territories to do whatever they want in regard to funding. That's not needs-based funding. We need our state and territory and our federal governments working together to ensure that we bring all of our kids up to a certain standard. And certainly this new model doesn't deliver that.
What does Gonski 2.0 mean for Indigenous schools and students?
The announcement about Gonski 2.0 is a significant distraction from what the Turnbull government should actually be doing in regard to school funding, and it will have a detrimental impact on many of our disadvantaged kids and in particular Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander students. So we're very concerned about the lack of funding that this government intends to provide for our kids to address their needs.
How do you think this funding change will affect future Indigenous student performance?
Well, we know that, sadly, our Indigenous kids are 2 to 3 years behind in terms of their literacy and numeracy outcomes. We know that far fewer Indigenous kids actually finish school. Sadly, we have far higher incarceration rates for young people, many more young people in detention than non-Indigenous people. The best way to support our Indigenous community and to ensure that our Indigenous kids get the education they need and deserve is to ensure that our schools are funded, that they're provided with adequate resources, and that those resources are targeted at the kids who most need additional support. And there's absolutely no question that our Indigenous kids need additional support. And, you know, I think the model that's being proposed means that our Indigenous kids continue to miss out and continue to fall behind the non-Indigenous kids in our community, and that's simply unacceptable.
Meredith Peace from the Australian Education Union. Lester Iribin-Arigny, a South Australian education expert, takes a more positive view on how Gonski will affect Indigenous education.
It's a step in the right direction. We've got to remember that Gonski's original funding for school disadvantage was a redistribution of funding on the basis of need, not to inject more money into the system.
How do you think this funding change will affect future Indigenous student performance?
Well, it will give those schools and the teachers within them to enact a new curriculum that really hasn't got a lot of resources to move towards a more culturally responsive education that the national curriculum is promoting. It's okay to have a national curriculum content, but it's up to a school's resources and finances to enact a national curriculum. So this gives us and gives teachers the ability to move into the national curriculum with confidence. It supports them and it makes a change sustainable if there is financial support. So the evidence clearly suggests that putting more funds in the hands of disadvantaged schools improves the overall educational outcomes of those schools.
Professor Lester Iribin-Arigny, South Australian education expert, ending that report from The Wire's Catherine Andrews. A political crisis is unfolding in Venezuela. Protesters have barricaded the streets of capital city Caracas in the wake of President Maduro's intentions to rewrite the constitution. Divisions in the country are escalating and it's heading to the status of a failed state. Where did it all go wrong for the country sitting on one of the largest oil reserves in the world? The Wire's Michael Magali reports.
The statistics are damning. 700% inflation and one of the highest murder rates in the world. Currently at 90 people for every 100,000. Compare that to the United States at 5 for every 100,000. Now Venezuela faces a political crisis with a trend of violent, confrontational politics forming, where discourse between parties breaks down, resulting in an angry, conflictual dynamic developing. It wasn't always like this, however. Former resident, now living in Sydney, Isabel Spetanik, describes life in the country with a family as recent as 12 years ago.
I tell you, it was beautiful. It was really lovely, very developed country and people really happy and everything. Not one person from Venezuela you would see in any other country. They all wanted to be there in their own country. Food were everywhere. The petrol, I mean, my nephew could fill up his tank of petrol for $1. But just after that, Hugo Chavez and all that type of thing, things has gotten worse. And every time I was going over there, I was thinking, I don't know whether I want to come back again.
Former Venezuelan resident Isabel Spetanik. Andrew Self is an associate researcher at the Institute of Latin American Studies at La Trobe University. He explains the trend towards confrontational politics, but also another economic issue plaguing the country.
10 years ago, you had Hugo Chavez, who was the president at that time, and now we have Nicolas Maduro, who's the president. Hugo Chavez was a much more skilled politician. He was able to negotiate with the opposition better. He was able to use his politicians better. He was able to communicate his message to the people much better, whereas Maduro is a much more, in some ways, classic leftist, quite hardline, and sees a lot of the opposition just as opposition. So he's quite black and white compared to the Chavez time. So because of this, we see divisions being opened up in how the opposition attacks the government. That's the first part around the discourse. The second part also is the currency and money problems. We see a huge drop in oil prices in the last 10 years, massive drops recently, you know, probably about a third of what it was 10 years ago in oil prices. And considering this is close to 90% of their income, that's going to create huge problems. Also, because of the dual currency system, they've got a very complicated currency system. That's caused a lot of problems with imports and exports. It basically means that it's very difficult to get many essential items into Venezuela. So some supermarkets are empty.
This is an issue Isabel and her family have experienced firsthand.
People couldn't find things in the shops, like food, not even for medication. My brother, for example, suffers from diabetes, and my other brother suffers from high blood pressure and all that type of sickness. They couldn't find any medication, no medication whatsoever. And you know what I used to do? We used to send boxes of, let's say, toilet paper, toothpaste, coffee, sugar, rice, all that type of thing to them because we knew that they didn't have it.
Dr. Raul Sanchez Uribarri is a lecturer in law and politics at the La Trobe University. He's also a Venezuelan national. I asked him just how close the country is to becoming a failed state.
And to be honest with you, the situation is further deteriorating pretty much by the day. I went in 2015, went in May 2015, and then again at the end of last year. And the decay in 15 months in a year and a half was astounding. I wasn't expecting, it's just in every single domain, that you see the country is slowly coming to a halt. Even the things that we would take for granted in the past are harder and harder to find. And not only in terms of the actual scarcity of essentials, which is already a major concern there, but even with respect to the basic state provisions and services. So can it become a failed state? Yes. Whether it would happen in a matter of months or longer, it depends on where this confrontation goes to.
Dr. Raul Sanchez Uribarri, lecturer in law and politics at La Trobe University, also a Venezuelan national, ending that report by The Wire's Michael Magali. Last year, 190,000 people arrived from other countries to work in Australia, and that number grows year by year. According to our recent survey, expats are pretty happy with their new home, but are we really being as welcoming to newcomers as we could, especially if they come from another culture? Annie Hastwell with this report.
World First is a company which specialises in moving people's money from country to country, a service expats obviously need. And recently they surveyed their clients to find out what they thought of Australia. As World First marketing manager Duncan Currie explained, overseas workers rate us highly.
Expats absolutely love Australia. In fact, they scored it 8 out of 10, with 30% of respondents, you know, giving this country 10 out of 10. Of course, it was led by our beaches and nature, the weather, the safety, working conditions, and the food and culinary scene were amongst the top responses there. Christmas in summer and on the beach was the top response that they found a little bit shocking or different. Bringing a plate to a dinner party or along to a barbecue was another one. Schoolies Week was another concept that was a bit foreign to expats. And I thought the funniest one was the fact that we eat our coat of arms in the kangaroo and emu. It was something that they found shocking, and to be quite honest, I do as well.
But how welcoming are we as a society to people from elsewhere? Duncan Currie says we could probably be more understanding of what expats go through as they get used to a new country.
It's one of those journeys. It's filled with challenges and emotions and risks, and I think they contribute a lot to, you know, to our society, not just in the workforce, but also in the community, and whether that's different cuisines. Or different clothing, I think that they can certainly add a lot to our culture in Australia and add to it.
Still, the adjustment isn't too great for those that responded to the survey. Most of the 2,000 plus who answered were from countries very like Australia. Alex Speedy from Pulse Recruitment, which deals with placing overseas workers in marketing jobs, agrees that most of the CVs he receives are Anglo-Saxon.
Yeah, we get more CVs, I would say, from the UK, Canada, the United States. We also get CVs from South America, but there's a large proportion come from India as well, yeah.
Have you come across any cases where someone from a country that wasn't Anglo-Saxon wanted to get a job and hit a few hurdles? Is it more difficult for them?
It is, very often because of that cultural difference, that employers won't look at their CVs. Well, there aren't many anyway who look outside of hiring Australians. They want to sort of keep that cultural fit, so to speak. But there are other employers who are up for sort of having a nice diverse workforce within their business. But yeah, there are some companies that just close the door on hiring people from outside of Australia.
So diversity is not really being welcomed much, is it?
It's something that could be improved on, that's for sure.
Alex Speedy says Australian companies would do well to open their doors more to hiring from overseas and from non-Anglo-Saxon countries.
A lot of Australian companies aren't even geared up to be able to nominate or sponsor, and I think are missing out on a lot of good talent. A few of my clients have actually shown them the benefits of hiring people from outside of Australia. And have done so, and the results have been very positive. So I think there's a lot more to do in that respect, and certainly would help the Australian economy develop and grow further.
NM Odi came to Australia as a skilled migrant from Palestine. She says Australia needs to accept some big changes in its migration mix if it's to survive economically.
The demographics of Australia is changing, and it's changing rapidly. Look at the Arab countries. More than 50% of the Arab countries are under the age of 25. Australia is an aging population. So in a few years' time, we cannot survive. Literally, we will have nobody to look after us who are growing older if we don't import workers. And those workers are going to be precisely from countries where they will be seeking employment. Because the Arab world, for example, there is not enough job within their countries to employ all of these 50% of the population. They'll have to go somewhere else. So that's the reality. We live in a globalized world. We need to accept this as a reality. And with globalized world means we need to put our own, you know, prejudices on the side and be curious about what could possibly that person bring to the workplace. So it's not about sameness, but rather about the diversity.
NM says she did encounter culture shock and some racism in Australia, but that our quaint cultural habit of bring a plate is a great way for Australians to welcome non-Anglo expatriates.
I love your culture of bring a plate. I could not understand what that meant, you know, when I first came to Australia. Well, I was thinking, don't they have enough plates? So, you know, just take an empty plate. You know, I can understand this, that sharing, we're equal. You know, you're coming to my place and bring your food. And, you know, and food is a wonderful way of engaging with each other. You know, I think I've fed everyone in my neighbourhood, you know.
Palestinian-Australian Enam Odi, ending that report by Annie Hastwell. That's it for The Wire today. The show is a team effort by 2SER, Radio Adelaide and 4EB in Brisbane. We'll be back again same time tomorrow, so please tune in again then. Today's program came from the studios of Radio Adelaide. I'm Bonnie Parker. Thanks for your company.